Hello and welcome to another Innovation Forum webinar with me, Ian Welsh. Today we are going to be discussing how the legislative landscape around forced labour and modern slavery is changing, and how companies that are not engaging in tackling these issues in their supply chains may find themselves barred from some markets, particularly the US. The 2016 US Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act introduced restrictions on importation into the US of goods produced with forced labour, closing a loophole in the 1930 Tariff Act that allowed for importation of goods that may have forced labour in the supply chain if US domestic production did not meet demand. This change last year came on the back of earlier legislation and rule changes in the US, including the Port State Measures Agreement and the Californian Transparency and Supply Chains Act, amongst others. Elsewhere, of course, the evolving picture is similar, with the UK's Modern Slavery Act having been in force since late 2015. France is another country with tightening rules coming into play. So clearly, companies need to act and be seen to act. But what are the implications if they don't? What are the risks they run? Indeed, how common is a corporate head-in-the-sand attitude? To lead our discussion over the next hour, we have three expert panellists. Ken Kennedy, Senior Policy Advisor, Forced Labour Programs at the US Immigration and Customs Enforcement with the Department of Homeland Security, joining us from Washington. We have Corey Norton, Export and Import Attorney at Trade Pacific Law, also joining us from the US. We have Darian McBain, Global Director of Sustainable Development at Thai Union, joining us from Thailand. And my thanks to my Innovation Forum colleague, Boris Petrovich, for convening our panel and organizing this webinar. The issues we're covering today will be discussed further at two upcoming Innovation Forum conferences on modern slavery and forced labor. Firstly, in London next month on the 25th and 26th of April, and then in Washington on the 26th and 27th of June. Full details are on Innovation Forum's website, where you can sign up now for best price passes. Well, back to today. I will shortly invite our panelists to make some opening remarks to kick things off. We will have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open the debate up to the audience questions in the second half of our hour. Now, we do want the webinar to be as interactive as possible today, so please do submit your questions using the comments box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. Questions can be directed to all the panel or to one panelist in particular, and if you can keep them short, it's more likely that I will use them. Please note that, as usual for Innovation Forum webinars, there will be no slides. This is a structured panel discussion throughout, and we are recording the discussion, and we will circulate that after the webinar. So, Ken, turning to you, perhaps you can start us off by giving some perspective from the US government on the key aspects of legislation now and what's going to be coming up next. Ken.
So thank you, Ian. Good morning, everyone, or good evening, everyone. My name is Kenneth Kennedy, and I manage the Forced Labor Program for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. I would like to thank the Innovation Forum for this opportunity to speak to such a respected audience today on the topic of forced labor enforcement efforts. I thought that I might begin with a very brief description of the law and regulations, since there has been a great deal of incorrect information recorded in blogs, media reports, and other sources. The law itself is 19 U.S.C. or United States Code 1307, and the regulation we're talking about is 19 Code of Federal Regulations 1242, all of which are available online. This law is not a new law, as some have reported. It's been around since 1930. However, in February 2016, President Obama signed the Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act, which contained a revision to the law, a very significant revision to the law. The revision dramatically changed the landscape within which trade enforcement relating to goods made using forced labor may be imported into the United States. The result was an opportunity for increased enforcement of this law. I am referring to the consumptive demand clause, which has now been removed. In short, that clause reflected that the origin of this law was a protectionist business law, as it required forced labor made goods, if not domestically produced in the U.S., in the quantity needed to meet U.S. consumer demand, must be allowed to be imported into the U.S. Again, that clause has now been removed. So what does that mean? Well, what it means basically is we have a new way forward on this law. Traditionally, there has not been a lot of enforcement relating to this law. If you Google it or search, there's not a lot of law relating to it or a lot of casework relating to it. So for 86 years or so, very little background to look at. So if you've been looking around trying to find about enforcement efforts and you haven't found anything, you're not missing anything. So the law is a challenge for all of the players, and it's a very significant challenge, particularly for us in law enforcement, because it's forcing us to act in ways that we traditionally do not, and in which we are traditionally not comfortable, being a very conservative, insular organization. So it's a challenge to us because we need to identify and use new or more inclusive methods to review allegations of forced labor. It's also a challenge to us to work with a broad range of stakeholders with widely varying needs, such as trade associations, NGOs, corporations, foreign governments, and other U.S. government agencies. This is an entirely new landscape for us. The traditional black and white enforcement efforts will solve everything is not going to work here. This is going to have to be a collaborative effort to move forward in this space. The point of the law was never to shut down U.S. commerce, but on the other hand, we now have to balance continuing U.S. commerce and effectively enforcing the law when matters delineate that it should be enforced. This law is now also a challenge to businesses and trade associations because it forces them and challenges them to work in a fairly new space relating to supply chain matters that are relating to increasingly complex supply chains and sourcing of materials. It challenges them to hold internal discussions and decide upon a path forward without clear and with sometimes conflicting guidance from the U.S. government as to what is expected. And it challenges businesses to compete with one another in a race to the top to combat forced labor in their supply chain. It's also a challenge to NGOs because it challenges them to identify ways of working with the business community on the subject instead of some who prefer to work against the business community in the enforcement efforts. It also challenges them to use and engage in improved strategy instead of encouraging boycotts, which often have unintended consequences for all parties, including the forced laborers themselves. So to close my opening, I would like to say that this is not something that cannot be done, but it is something that is challenging and all of us must pick up our piece of the puzzle. We must find ways to engage other stakeholders, corporate boards, and senior public officials, and the American people. To fail to do this would leave U.S. businesses vulnerable to unfair pricing and competition from both foreign competitors, as well as domestic competitors who are not policing their supply chains for forced labor. Also, to fail to do this leaves millions of people being exploited on a daily basis in conditions of slavery and the worst of human cruelty. We are at a pivotal point in this moment. All of us, the U.S. government, the business community, and the NGOs can either accept this challenge and learn to work together to combat forced labor and supply chains, or we will fail with both economic and human costs as a result. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks, Ken. Just a quick question from me. I mean, it's early days, but have you had any indication of a change in approach with the new administration in the White House?
Well, U.S. government attorneys are probably going crazy if I answer that. But so far, there has been very little guidance. Everything that's come out of the White House thus far has been focused sort of on the human immigration side of matters. There have been a couple policy statements and one executive order that came out about 2 weeks ago that talked about human trafficking and forced labor and modern slavery as it relates to transnational criminal organizations. And that executive order is about the only solid piece that we have so far to guess that forced labor enforcement is going to be ratcheted up during this administration. But again, nothing solid.
Sure. Okay. Thanks, Ken. Thanks. Appreciate you answering that one for us off the top. Okay. Corey, turning to you, what are the impacts, good and bad, that legislation change has had on your clients? And what are the things that you see companies getting wrong, the kind of most common pitfalls? Corey, over to you.
Great. Well, thank you, Ian, and good morning or good afternoon or good evening to everybody out there. It's quite impressive. The audience and range of individuals and companies that have interest in the area, but the interest is certainly warranted and understandable and to be supported. I think just to kick off, Ian, I would echo Ken's comments and acknowledge really some of the main points of what he had to say, that this is a very important change in U.S. law. I think everybody would agree, and that our U.S. Customs and Immigration and Customs Enforcement authorities have a very important job. I think everybody would agree, but certainly a challenging job. And I'll follow up and pick up where Ken left off on the challenges for industry, which are quite real too. And the point of view I have as a lawyer for companies, both exporters to the United States and also their partners in the United States who are trying to comply with this law. Generally, I would say that the clients I work with are those who want to do the right thing, I think as maybe you teed off, Ian, and have, I would say, for several years been putting in significant efforts. But this this change to the U.S. forced labor laws does create a new challenge. And the way I like to explain and to think about the challenge, and I think this is somewhat unique among U.S. laws in the ways that companies need to implement it, is to think about the role that customs must be in. If they're examining a import into the United States and they've received reliable information that imported good might have been made somewhere in the supply chain with forced labor, it's quite a challenge for customs to figure out exactly what information are they going to rely upon and what would they expect from the importer and the exporter. So if a company that has exported that product wants to be sure, say in advance right now, that its supply chain doesn't have forced labor in it, you really have to undergo an exercise where you review from import all the way back up to supply chain to origin, all of the practices in your supply chain. But I'd say most importantly, need to be able to prove it first to yourself and then to outsiders, particularly the U.S. government, but it may be also be to customers, to outside organizations. And this is where I think the particular challenge comes in, that consider a situation where, you know, even in the best of circumstances, say an allegation has been made against you, but you're quite certain that it's not true. Well, there raises the challenge of how do you prove that? Certainly, you want to see companies that have very strong statements and cultures of compliance, and coming from the top management saying this area is very important to us. We're investing all appropriate resources. But when it comes down to proving that a given import didn't have forced labor in its supply chain, I think what you really have to look at is an exercise with two parts to it. One really is a chain of custody exercise. If you're a company looking inwardly, can we backtrack from that import through the supply chain for all those materials and show the chain of custody at each stage in production all the way back up to wherever the claim might have been? And then at the stage of production, the stage in supply chain where the claim addresses, do we have evidence to show that the labor conditions at that point weren't forced, that they were all appropriate? And there are many indicia one might look at in different industries, the evidence you have is going to change. So I just think that backtracking and dual chain of custody and maintaining evidence of appropriate labor conditions is a new challenge for industry. Other legal obligations deal with part of that. We have quality control within factories that provides part of the traceability and other recall obligations and issues like that. But really, I don't think there are other laws that are quite as comprehensive going all the way from import back through to origin. And I think that's really the new challenge. And so it's a challenge at the point when an allegation might arise, but the best practices, I think I see companies now, and frankly, I think industry generally is aware of how important this issue is. And even if they have been taking this issue on independent of the government mandate, are realizing that it's in their interest to begin doing internal reviews now to make sure they can prove that import to origin process. So that's what I see exporters to the United States and their U.S. partners thinking about. Now, I should say that, just maybe just wrap up one follow-on thought, is that there's a lot of benefit to going through that exercise, both in terms of ensuring for your own company that your supply chain is free of forced labor and that you can defend yourself if there ever was an incorrect allegation. But I think going through that internal review process, you should you identify any gaps, you can certainly fix them, but you also start coming up with protocols that satisfy yourself that you're free of forced labor. But I think those protocols have a benefit to outside audiences as well. So just as Ken was saying, the U.S. government is in a phase of trying to figure out how to leverage resources, both within industry and NGOs, et cetera. As industry itself develops its resources for the protocols that evaluate the existence of forced labor, there's an opportunity to share those with U.S. government. Obviously, that can be a sensitive exercise for industry, but when appropriate, I know U.S. government has been had open ears and interested in learning how to evaluate industry in the best way. But also, those protocols can be used to satisfy customer inquiries. Consumers in the United States rely upon their retailers to vet their overseas suppliers. And so the basic point here is that, of course, there's sensitivity, a lot of times the confidentiality. But as a company reviews itself and figures out the best way to explain to the outside world, there's a lot of benefit there for all audiences that have an interest in ensuring the supply chains are free of forced labor. So there certainly are new challenges, even for companies that have been doing all the right things. Those new challenges, I think, have a benefit for everybody moving forward. So we leave the thoughts out there.
Thanks, Corey. I wondered, you talked about the various challenges in the new, around the new legal position. Is the starting point of assumption that there is no forced labor in imports, or does an importer have to prove for every import that it's forced labor free? How does it work?
No, you do not need to prove for every import. There's no, for example, with every import, you always declare your classification and value and origin and things of that sort. There's no mandate with each import to provide evidence showing a supply chain was free of forced labor. The requirement or the best practice for industry is, particularly when you're in a higher risk industry or higher risk country, is to be in a position where you can provide that information really at a moment's notice or a very quick turnaround if there is an allegation against your industry or your imports or your country, industry or company. So no, you don't need to have it prepared for every single import or provided for every single import, but the reviews to be done now should satisfy yourself that you could provide that information for any given import.
So companies need to take an assessment as to where certain things are coming from, and there may or may not be a greater or lesser risk from those locations.
That's correct.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Corey. Darian, Thai Union has had a number of high-profile exposés of modern slavery in its supply chains, and the seafood sector in particular is one that has inbuilt forced labor risks. So, from your perspective, how has strengthening the legislative landscape helped drive necessary change? And to what extent has this change been an enabler or driver of Thai Union's change in approach? Darian.
Thank you, Ian. And thanks to the Innovation Forum for hosting this session. And thank you, Corey and Ken, for the really interesting comments. So I'll try to follow up on a few of those points provided. Businesses have been following the likes of the UN Guiding Principles on Human Rights, or the RUGI principles, for a number of years. We've had the UN Global Compact and some global frameworks for assessing human rights in business operations and, to an extent, supply chain. But the increase of legislation that's coming out now, both from the US and really other parts of the world, is changing the way that businesses look at this. No longer can you just focus on it as a nice thing to do. It is an essential part of running a business. So I think from a corporate perspective, the increase in regulation actually helps raise the bar for everyone. So it has a particular focus on setting the floor to make sure there's a common playing field, that everybody is working towards those same standards. But it doesn't set the ceiling. So businesses who really want to prove that they're going further still have that opportunity to be proactive and to do more. It's interesting that Corey spoke about the onus of proof and chain of custody within your supply chain. And I think any proactive company managing their supply chains now must have that chain of custody really as a basis. And at Thai Union, we talk about traceability as being the backbone of our sustainability program, because if you don't have that full traceability and the chain of custody, you certainly can't begin to understand what the risks of forced labor in your supply chain are. And so we really do look at traceability as being fundamental to going towards proving how we can comply with legislation such as the Trade Facilitation and Enforcement Act. I think one of the complexities is in that bonus, the burden of proof, and how relatively new some of this legislation is. So really the California Transparency and Supply Chain Act started to push this agenda. Certainly as a global company, we've found the UK Modern Slavery Act has pushed the agenda a bit further. Now with the recent announcement of the French duty of care law, you can see that multiple jurisdictions are all starting to push in the same direction, even if there are some differences in how they're enacted in different states. Environmental protection legislation has been around for a number of years, or in some cases, 3-4 decades. And so I think businesses have had the time to understand how they can comply, whereas all of this information around forced labour is still relatively new. And one of the challenges that we find as a business is how can you verify something that's constantly changing? So you could have all of the correct policies in place, you can have the right commitments, but it often comes down to human choices at parts within your supply chain, which could be very far away from where you're investigating. And that individual decision-making can really make it a challenge to tighten up your control of the supply chain. So we know that people don't always choose the most logical and optimal options that they have presented to them. And I'll give you an example of this. We at Thai Union have recently implemented a zero recruitment fee policy. We did that working with one of the NGOs in Thailand, Migrant Workers Rights Network. And we found, and MWRN has found this through work separate to Thai Union as well, that people coming to have employment, migrants particular coming to Thailand, don't actually believe that recruitment fees don't exist or that they're free. So even though we have the policy and we have the recruitment agents who are not charging workers fees, people still are looking to pay a fee because they don't believe that it's true. So in this case, it's not just a matter of implementing a policy and even following it up. You really need to change culture. And I think that's part of the change that businesses are going through at the moment, that culture change for managing supply chains to manage the human rights risk. And I think it highlights another point that you really do need to work with, say, NGOs and other partners, because it's difficult to do this alone, and industry collaboration on particular issues. Ian mentioned the seafood industry. There's some good collaboration that's going on within the seafood industry now, where there's recognition that issues of forced labour can be found anywhere in the seafood supply chain. And actually what we need is to have consistent approach to management and enforcement. So on that consistent approach, I think we'd say that the legislation is really an enabler for improved practices, and it really is starting to drive change. And when you have a large importing country such as the United States having legislation that strongly encourages companies to go down the path of managing human rights, that actually makes the path a bit clearer about where you need to go.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Darian. Turning to our central question, I wondered, for Thai Union, was there a fear of market access denial that helped push change? And where did that sit within the other risks, you know, corporate reputation, supply security, and so on? So where did the risk of market access denial sit within the others for Thai Union?
So you're right that it's risk management from all of those perspectives. It has to be access to markets. It has to be to be able to show that to your customers that you are a preferred supplier. It also relates, in Thai Union's case, to our overall values and that we're trying to be a leader in the seafood industry and demonstrate change. And I don't think you can separate out any of those issues. They all do go together.
Thank you very much indeed. Great. Well, thank you very much to our panelists. Excellent opening open discussion. And thank you very much to the audience, too, for questions. They're coming in thick and fast. And I'd like to go straight to one, which I think is a fundamental question that perhaps we should have addressed earlier, is really looking at definitions. And our questioner asks, is there a generally accepted definition of forced labour for this legislation? Ken, I wonder if you could just comment on that. What is the definition of forced labour that that these new rules and changes have used? Ken?
Yes, and it's published in the law itself. So when the law was put together, the U.S. government put the definition of what we would consider to be forced labor in the law itself. So again, you can go online and look up 19 U.S.C. 1307 and get your definition.
Right, can you give us a quick summary of what that is?
It's fairly similar to a conglomeration of a bunch of laws from around the world without the. It doesn't get caught up in the terminology of human trafficking versus forced labor versus human modern slavery and so on. But it's basically any individual who is coerced or forced through threat of physical violence, sexual violence, economic consequences or so on to work, to produce something. Very, very broad definition there. But
sure. Okay, thanks very much indeed, Ken. Turning to you, Corey, just moving on from that a little, our questioner asks particularly, what are the consequences of having proved forced labour in an import? What are the sanctions that companies risk immediately and perhaps then long term? Corey?
Well, the most immediate consequence is, and maybe to take a step back, the way this would work is, Either U.S. Customs on its own initiative, or someone has presented this information to Customs. Customs has done its vetting of that information and concluded that there's a reasonable indication of forced labor. Once the U.S. government has made that conclusion, there's the law kicks in and has a mandate that the particular import at issue be blocked, so the import cannot enter the United States at that point. The importer, together with their overseas supplier, has an opportunity at that point to share their own vetting information they might have that they can do with the U.S. government within a short window thereafter. But if you can't overcome the initial conclusion the government's reached, then that import that was at issue is denied access to the U.S. market. And imports of that product from that supplier continue to be denied access to the U.S. market. So your market access is disrupted is the main consequence, to the main commercial consequence at that point.
Thank you very much indeed. Another question, and I thought I'd put this to you, Corey, while we're on the line. What about, where does the ownership or accountability in an importing? Is it the ultimate brand, say, that's importing the goods or are going to be selling them in the retail environment? Or is it an import agent that has the responsibility for the for the importing of the and for the any slavery in the supply chain of the imported good? Or is it a joint responsibility? Where does the responsibility lie?
Well, I would say, practically speaking, it is a joint responsibility because the overseas producers and exporters are generally in best position to have the information about forced labor in the supply chain. But the U.S. importer has quite a bit of responsibility as well as the one having control over the import. But legally, the U.S. importer is the touch point that the U.S. government will go to. So the U.S. importer needs to be prepared and ideally have worked in advance with its foreign suppliers because the government will keep in mind that this activity is triggered by imports into the United States. So the U.S. government will turn to the importer, who then has to go to get information from the exporter. So that there are joint responsibilities and different roles for each side there, I should say, to work together.
Sure, thank you. Darian, I wonder if I can turn that to you and look at it the other way around. How has how have these changes in legislation, particularly in the US, how have they changed the relationship that Thai Union has with your customers? And I guess it must have sharpened the edges a little bit, because it goes beyond simply, we expect there to be no forced labor in the supply of these goods. But in fact, now it goes beyond that. There has to be none. Otherwise, there won't be there will be a risk of supply security. Darian, so how has that changed the relationship?
So Thai Union acts as both an importer but also the producer who has the responsibility in the supply chain. So we do have both aspects to manage. This legislation has, I think, highlighted how serious the issue is and that it's an essential part of doing business in the United States. Customers are particularly concerned about reputation and also how consumers feel about their products. So if a consumer feels concerned about the source of their products, obviously our customers are very keen to have proof that they can share with consumers about how the goods are sourced. So I don't think this legislation has necessarily changed the requirements of customers in the United States. But again, going back to Corey's point, it's helped us have structure in managing the risk and the proof points of how we manage the risk within the supply chain. So identifying which points are high risk and what are the mitigating actions we are taking at each of those points. And so I think since the legislation has been enacted, we're in a much better position to very clearly communicate to our customers, these are the programs that we have in place, this is how we're managing risks, this is how we're reducing the risks, and these are the next challenges that we're looking towards.
And have you found the questions that your customers are asking you have changed? Was there a kind of a step change in approach from the customer side?
Again, I think there's a mix of factors that are influencing the customer perception. So legislation gives them a certain amount of assurance that the products are being produced without forced labour. It also highlights how important it is to manage the risk. I don't think the discussion has changed just because of this legislation, but I think it reinforces that this isn't just a media headline that is going to go away. It's something that's there for good about how businesses import goods and how they do business.
Okay, thanks very much. Ken, turning to you, again, a definitional point coming in from our audience. And the questioner asks, to what extent must forced labor have contributed to the production of a product in order to prevent its entry into the United States? So if, say, one small component of a finished product was produced or there was potentially produced with forced labor, is that enough to block the finished product entirely? Ken?
That's actually a very good question, because if you read the regulation, now that the consumptive demand piece has been removed, the next piece of the regulation that's unclear, and I think Corey will back me up on this, is there's a phrase in there, wholly or in part. And what that means is that the good was produced wholly or in part using forced labor. That standard has not been well defined, if defined at all, in terms of past law and past usage of the regulation. So there's been a lot of discussion within the government and amongst businesses and so on as to what does that mean. And there is no clear definition right now, and I think that's going to be the next item up on the agenda for the government to clarify, that if it's an agricultural product like cotton, are we saying that the water used the fertilizer used to fertilize the crop, if the fertilizer was produced with forced labor, is that enough to raise the wholly or in part bar? Or are we simply talking about a sneaker made from many components and one of those components has to be produced with forced labor? So that's actually a very good question, but there's no answer yet. And I think, as Darian said, you're seeing that the laws are, even if not new, sort of evolving as quickly as companies' reactions to them.
Thank you. Corey, do you have any comment on that point? The extent that forced labor is or is not involved in certain aspects of our product, is that something that your clients or your contacts are coming up with, or a concern, a point of concern for them?
It is a question that comes up quite frequently. Maybe I should just say sort of the grouping of questions as companies are evaluating their supply chains, sort of maybe three arise quite frequently. I mean, one is that issue of are we looking at our raw materials, our packaging, our ingredients, sort of what's the scope of what we have to look at? Maybe just while I'm on that quick train of thought, you know, other issues are how far back up our supply chain do we go? Supply chains are complex, as we know, many parties, and that falls in the same category where the law, in concept, goes all the way back and does cover everybody. And guidance, I'm sure, will come out as Ken was saying. And maybe the third question also is, there are many parties in supply chains one can't always control. And as Darren was saying, there are moving pieces, and the best practices for controlling as best we can. And I'm sure as time moves forward, industry will be asking the government for kind of its assessment of best practices of how to review and keep track of those moving pieces. So there are a lot of those questions that have practical implications for the compliance procedures and reviews companies put in place. But they're I think driven by the statute is extremely broad. There are few, if none, clear limitations in the statute on any of those issues. And it leaves companies in a position where they at this point do need to try to account for everything, or at least as much as they can. Maybe just one way to illustrate that a little bit on what Ken was saying about the wholly or in part, that's absolutely true. And a few other words without getting too in the weeds that precede that are, we're looking at goods mined, produced, or manufactured wholly in part. And as from a lawyer's eye, the way when you see many different words in the statute, you have to give them all meaning. So practically what that means is that you might be looking at a part of the supply chain that is considered to produce something is different than part of the supply chain that manufactures it. Now that all just starts getting a little mumbo jumbo, but the basic point is that the law, by using many different words, is trying to get at many different parts of the supply chain and parts of the product. So it's correct what Ken was saying. Now, when I talk about this, I often start from that position of saying the law is broad. And yes, the law does have the ability to cover all these things. I think practically the way you see companies dealing with that, because there's a certain impossibility to giving the same amount of effort to your raw materials that might be higher risk as to ingredients that, a spice, a piece of plastic that covers something. And that there are probably degrees of magnitude here. And I think the way companies are approaching it is doing their risk assessment to figure out where the higher priority risks are and at least starting there. And as you have those under control, then working your way through your risk assessment. But there has to be a starting point, even though the law is quite broad. And to Ken's point, I'm sure we'll see more guidance on that as we move forward.
Thanks very much, Corey. So I think we can safely say that we've established that there is a definite problem for companies. It's something they need to really engage with. I'd like to move a little bit now into the sort of solutions that companies can use to tackle the challenge. We have a question from our audience asking, what are the sorts of recognized certification and audit schemes that companies can apply? I think let's dig a little bit further and see, well, what are the characteristics of the good certification and audit schemes that companies can use? Darian, perhaps you can think about that first.
Sure. I don't think there's any one certification scheme that's going to meet all of the requirements to prove that you're compliant with the Trade Facilitation and Enforcement Act. Certainly that's my experience with seafood supply chains, and that could be because they're dealing with multiple species, both wild caught and aquaculture, and across multiple countries. It really does come down to that risk assessment and understanding where those points are. So if I give an example of, we have certified, third-party certified to an auditable labour standard parts of our shrimp feed supply chain in Thailand. We have certification of our factories. There's certification and audits that are going on in different parts of our supplier's supply chain. But there isn't one particular tick that can say, you now have full demonstrated compliance to the Trade Facilitation Enforcement Act, because you need to look at each of those risk points. And so that's the process that we're going through now. That's looking at your chain of custody and each step of the process, and what do you have in place to manage and minimise that risk.
Thank you. Ken, I wonder if I could turn to you from the legislative perspective, what sort of things are you wanting companies to do, and what sort of schemes or audit trail analysis are you wanting to see companies applying that will the legislation is trying to bring into being? My point is, what are you looking for as a legislator for companies to do, and what sort of tools should they be using?
So I agree with Darian that there are a number of schemes out there, and the government is probably never going to come out and say, this is the one you need to do. So a lot of it is common sense that you either have to find one that applies to the sector you're looking at or the type of production you're looking at that covers all of the factors that you wish to have covered in your supply chain. So if companies are looking for sort of the magic answer, it's far too specific and far too tailored to be able to do that. Of course, using common sense, there are numerous certification schemes out there that on the surface, if you look at, you very quickly realize there's not a lot of depth there. So if there are no, for example, unannounced audits, or the questionnaires are given to employees on the factory floor, but the factory managers are still sitting there and so on. So all of these are sort of red flags. If a company was to give us their, here's how we certify our supply chain, you know, these are the methods we use. And again, this is another example of where we on the enforcement side really don't have a lot of experience with this. So we would go to the experts in labor certification schemes, the U.S. Department of Labor and others, and say, okay, is this a good process that this company is using? And we would very much value their input. So I think there's no easy answer to that. And I think to a few things that Corey had said, that when a shipment is detained at the border, the clock starts ticking. So the company is notified, and it's usually the company where the forced labor allegations So the company where the forced labor allegations state that the forced labor occurred, they're the ones who are named on the withhold release order. The exporter and the importer are usually the ones notified. So the problem with this sort of setup is the clock starts ticking when the shipment is detained. The company then has 90 days or 3 months, if you read the law, to present information to the U.S. government saying, oh, no, you're wrong. There was no forced labor involved in the production of these goods. So if, as both Darian and Corey have been saying, you as a company have not done your due diligence ahead of time, you have a very short window now as a company to come forward with some sort of track record or demonstrated look into your supply chain within the 90-day window that you can then demonstrate to the U.S. government that you have been looking at forced labor in your supply chain. So the idea that you as a company should be doing this in advance, using your own standards, using the parameters that you find most effective for your business, is a very valid point. If you are waiting for the U.S. government to stop goods at the border, Remember that it doesn't have to be your company's goods that get stopped at the border, because if the report gets out that goods were stopped at the border or withhold release order, which is public information, has been issued, the consumer reaction may very well be to boycott that good, whether it's your company that has their goods stopped at the border or not. So there are all sort of implications that it may be much broader than you want it to be, and to wait for that potential stopping of goods at the border for your company to jump into this area is probably not the best policy.
I've got a question I want to move on to Corey, to Norton. If a company does find it's got forced labor in its supply chain and detects through its own process that it has some forced labor, what should it do then? Should it work in remediation? Should it halt the import straight away? What is the process, Corey, that you'd recommend for your clients?
Well, as you probably would guess, there's a lot of sensitivity and quite a range of reactions there. And I think the most obvious and issue off the bat is the issue has to be fixed. And generally, whenever you have something like this, there's an appropriate internal investigation with counsel under attorney-client privilege, at least initially, to be able to get the truth and figure out what happened. But the really initial thrust has got to be what happened, and we need to fix it so it doesn't happen again. There are then a whole bunch of variations that might happen, say, in tandem with that or after, depending on do you have goods on the water, do you have orders that are coming, and there are going to be degrees of risk that companies might take. So, for example, they might not know for sure the range of products that were affected and things of that nature. But I think so there are going to be different reactions of either maybe the most extreme pulling goods from the supply chain, and that in cases may be easier said than done, but there may be times when that's appropriate and feasible. But I think one issue on this to consider is that generally under, I guess I'd venture to say most U.S. government legal compliance programs, there's generally a provision by the implementing agency that essentially says you regulated community, if you find a problem with your compliance, come bring the issue to us after you've investigated it and found out what the issue is and fixed it. And by being transparent and clearing the slate, there'll be some preferential treatment, if I could say it that way. That might be saying a little bit too much, but often penalties start at a lower scheme or things of that nature. But the U.S. government has a general concept that in instances of noncompliance, we give you, the regulated community, the option to come to us and we'll treat you a little bit better in figuring out the consequence of this problem. Now, that there probably is some room for some version of that in under this forced labor law, but it's a different creature though, because customs I'm sure couldn't say, well, thank you for telling us. Now that you've told us, the benefit we'll give you is to let the imports keep coming in. They can't do that. So it's going to be I'm sure customs would want to encourage disclosure and transparency, but the motivation on industry's part to do so and the benefit they might get, at least as far as the government's reaction, is going to be a little bit difficult because there's only so much the government can offer. And I think that's going to be wait and see whether there's some room there. Maybe options one might consider, there may be ability to block an import that's at issue, but perhaps if a company has shown a strong compliance program, maybe all the company's future imports might not be affected in the same way. I'm just making things up, frankly, as I'm thinking out loud, but there is generally some room to work with the government if you've decided in your company's interest that's the right balance. But what that means in this context, is not yet determined and will be challenging, but perhaps something like that will come about too.
Thank you, Corey. I'd like to put that point straight to Darian, the transparency point. How much do you feel, and this can be within Thai Union or perhaps more generally in your experience of the sector, perhaps, is there a dilemma in companies to on that transparency point? Because if they are transparent, then suddenly they will not be able to get goods potentially into, for example, the US in this case. What is it? How does a company work out that dilemma, Darian?
I think transparency is important when you're going back to the issues of trust, whether it's your customers who trust you or the US government who trusts you as an importer and a producer. So there is value in being transparent. I could understand if a company hadn't done anything, then it's difficult to have that level of transparency. But the approach that Thai Union tends to take is to be very transparent in the processes that we're going through, to be transparent on where the risks are and what those processes that we're putting in place are, and let people know this is the direction that we're going in. And generally, I have found Ken and colleagues in the US government, but also our customers, to be very open to that approach, that if we are transparent with them, if there are risks that we're managing them, then they will allow us the opportunity to manage those risks. I think there's also another important point in there that Ken raised, which is if goods are stopped with the suspicion of forced labour, even if it isn't necessarily your supply chain, it can affect the whole industry. So with seafood, a stop of a shipment from, say, Thailand could really affect the whole seafood industry. So that brings up another change that perhaps this legislation is helping to facilitate, and that's pre-competitive actions to address forced labour in supply chains where there's common or shared supply chains. And I think that's a very positive move that this Act is starting to have on different parts of the supply chain, where there are those high risks that people work together with programs, because generally supply chains will be common. It might be to a fishery, it might be common to a plantation or an area or a community. And there is, you get a lot more value of working together with companies who may, in other circumstances, be your competitors. But on the issue of forced labour, if we all work together, we can have a much stronger outcome.
Isn't that pre-competitive collaboration is a big issue in the forced labour and modern slavery debate? Ken, we are coming towards the end of our time, so I'd like please keep our responses very quick now. Ken, a very quick question to you. From the US government perspective, how far up the supply chain is it reasonable for customs to expect companies to have control?
Well, I think we have to be honest that there's a difference between reasonable and what the law actually says. And I'm not saying one is better than the other, but reasonable is interpreted to each company. But the law says, basically, going back to raw materials, not clearly, of course, but that's sort of the interpretation. And again, that will play out over the next few years, I would imagine. So I think companies need to be looking as far back as they can get. And yes, it's incredibly difficult because the law is almost 100 years old and was written for very simple supply chains that no longer exist. So I think a lot of this is interpretive and notional at this point, but it's going to sort of push the envelope a little bit in the future. And just to reflect on something Darian said, I do actually read company websites and company reports all the time. And if I see companies are reacting and acting positively and proactively in this space, then that says a lot about the company if and when we do get information that there is forced labor in their supply chain. So as Corey alluded to, that is something we could take into account if we have out information or we have stopped goods at the border, that here we have a demonstrated track record by this company. It may not be in the sector we're talking about, because of course there are so many sectors in a large corporation's portfolio, but here we have them actually acting on this, which sends a very positive message to the government, even if it is to a different commodity.
Great. Thank you, Ken. Right, a final question that I think we can use as a nice way to wrap things up. The question our audience members asked about the interaction between private and public standards and where best practice is now. So let's move that on a little bit and ask our panelists, where are they seeing best practice now in this area? And what is going to be next in terms of best practice. Ken, perhaps, in fact, no, Corey, we'll go to you first. Corey.
Well, I think a common theme through what all three of us have mentioned is that we're in a new era, new challenges, and that existing audit schemes, existing means of reviewing yourself, et cetera, are not individually sufficient. So that there are new best practices that every industry has to develop. And I'd say the best practice in any given industry is what a company is finding through its own proactive, preventative, internal reviews at this point. And as companies find where the issues are and how to fix them and how to track them and how to prove them, that collective set of information really is the best practice to guide the company, perhaps work with the government, perhaps work with customers. But that self-initiated set of results is the first step in figuring out that best practice in my mind.
Great. Thank you, Corey. Ken, you've had a couple of minutes to think about it. Perhaps you can just give us a big scoop and tell us what the next, where the next big US legislation is going to be and what it's going to be all about.
I wish I could tell you that. I have no idea. But in terms of best practices, I would say two. Number one would be collaborate and partner during this time as we're putting things together. And it can either be businesses partnering together with businesses in the same field or same commodities, or with NGOs if you're comfortable doing that. And then the other one would be take advantage of civil servants who are out on the road like me, who are willing to answer questions, who are willing to talk to you and say, well, we don't know, we don't have all the answers. However, have you thought about this? There are a number of corporations who call me all the time on the sly, on private, and we have conversations that never happened because they just want to ask questions about what if or what does this mean or how does the government interpret this? And it's not binding. It's just a conversation. So take advantage of that. My email information, my contact information is available to everybody. If there are questions, I'm perfectly happy to answer them, but take advantage of all of these resources.
Thank you, Ken. Hope you don't mind me asking. You never know, I might have had an answer on the next, what's next, what's going to be big next. Darian, turning to you then, just to wrap things up then, for your perspective, you know, where are you seeing best practice now and you know, what's going to be next?
Well, I think one of the good practices that's being driven is the transparency in your supply chain. You have to know what's happening in your supply chain to comply with this legislation. As for what's next, I guess my hope is that we can move from the multitude of different standards that producers are asked to comply with at the moment, all of the different certification standards, and move to one system where people can have trust in the supply chains. And whether that be from a government perspective or a customer perspective or a consumer perspective, how can we build up that trust that people do understand whether there is or isn't a force majeure in the supply chain?
Diane, thank you very much indeed. We're coming to the end of our hour, so I'm going to stop the discussion now as we are running out of time. Thank you very much to our panel for their time and insight today. And thank you very much for listening, everybody. Once again, if you'd like to continue the debate on modern slavery risks, then please do join us in London in April or in DC in June. We will send you a recording of this webinar so you can listen again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. We also have some feedback, so please don't hesitate to contact any of us at Innovation Forum with your follow-up questions and comments. For now, apologies for a few technical issues, but I hope you found the past hour interesting, and thank you very much indeed for listening.